Welcome back to the Lutheran History Podcast. Today we pick up with the second half of my interview with the Wells archivist, Susan Willems.
All switching gears here, apart from fulfilling research requests or assisting walk-ins with their request, you do some other things, as you already mentioned, in your typical week. One of those things was cataloging and archiving collections. Well, what's the purpose? What's the benefit of doing that?
So, if you were to take a look in the storage area that I have here for the archives, all you would see is rows upon rows upon rows of shelves of boxes. And that intimidates a lot of people, because how do you know what's in these boxes? How do you know, to go and pull that particular box off the shelf when somebody asks a question about, President Brenner versus a different box? And that's what I do when I catalog materials. So I know what's in that box. And then that catalog is actually available online for people to go through before they come here. So sometimes, especially researchers who, like the academic researchers who are looking for a broad topic, they're looking to try to paper on a broad topic, I can direct them to that online catalog, and they can see that, oh, there's some material that fits that topic in this collection on Brenner's presidency, but then there's also some material in the, the Michigan Home Missions collection and stuff like that. So they're actually able to very specifically tell me, I would like to see box 5 in this collection because it looks like it has material that fits my topic. So that's a really important role in as being an archivist, because otherwise you just have all of these boxes and you don't know what's in them and you don't know where to find the material that's being requested. And it can make for a very challenging day. But if it's all organized and you know what's in the boxes, it makes it very easy then to go and just grab what the researcher is looking for.
Yeah, and just from kind of a researcher's perspective, I've kind of noticed there's just this pattern, no matter what archive you go, if it's organized at all, it's usually a collection of some kind, and it may be several boxes worth, but then it has little folders and say, well, this folder has this, this folder has that. Maybe your thing you're looking at is just one folder in one box, but it's usually a box and a folder. Are those basically and maybe a collection? Those are the basic numbering units, right, for an archive?
Right. So here at the Synod Archive, we organize things. The largest level is the collection level. So you have a collection of the President Brenner collection. And then within that collection, you can have series of topics. So all of his correspondence is organized together. All of his Synod Convention reports are organized together. So then those are kind of the next level. So you have a collection and then you have series. And then the series are organized into boxes. So then you have the box. And then within the boxes are the folders. So there's kind of that little hierarchical level of cataloging that we do. Bare minimum here at the Synod Archives, I try and do a collection series and box level for all of our collections. So I might not know specifically that this piece of paper is in this folder, but I know what box it's in, and then that can narrow it down and we can find it a lot easier than, if I only knew, well, what series was it in? Because this series can have multiple boxes. So then you'd be rifling through the boxes.
And since we can't picture it on a podcast, but you walk into the archives, the boxes are all the same size. It's not typically, right? It's pretty standard.
They are all the same size. They're the same color. Really, there's not a lot to differentiate them from each other, and stuff. And it's really, it really is up to the archivist to make sure that things are cataloged somewhere, whether that's the online collection, or I know smaller archives will use Excel spreadsheets, to keep track of where things are, the collection organization and stuff like that, because to someone who doesn't work in archives, you walk back in there and you're just staring at boxes that all look the same, wondering, where am I going to find this piece of paper?
Yeah. I had a little bit of unprofessional experience with that as a student at Martin Luther College. They said, well, we kind of need to know what's inside all of these boxes in our archives. And some of the boxes were the same size and others were just boxes. And you never knew what you're going to find when you opened it up. So my job was just to literally just type a description, at least with a box number. This is box number so-and-so. Right. This is what's in it. To let someone else actually organize and say, well, this should be in this collection or that collection. But yeah, you got to start somewhere and you got to know what you have before you go anywhere else.
Exactly.
So do you know what's in every box by now, or are you still kind of discovering stuff?
I do not know what's in every box by now. I have a good idea of what's in groups of boxes. And so that was one of the benefits of being in charge of moving the archives from the seminary out to the Center for Mission Ministry, was that I really got to take the time to at least group boxes that had the same type of subject material together. So while I might not know what's in that particular box of a group, I know that, say, these 10 boxes all relate to home missions. And from there, I can kind of narrow it down. That really was one of the big things that I did in that move preparation, was just try and group like boxes together, so that when I got them over here, like I said, I might not know what's in box number 2 of that group, but I know that all of those boxes relate to home missions.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that was an opportunity. You're going to move them all anyways. You might as well move them in an organized way. So,
right.
Yeah. All right. Next, let's talk about your administrative duties. What do they look like?
So, you know, again, that kind of varies on time of year. Here in the Synod, you know, every other year we have a Synod convention that's held, where departments within the Synod have to give reports. So like this year, one of my big administrative roles was to write my report for what we call the Book of Reports and Memorials. And so all of that's used in preparation then for the Synod Convention. So I tell in that report, I go over what I've done since the last Synod Convention, what I'm currently working on, and what I plan to work on between now and the next Synod Convention. So that's one of, so every other year that's a really big major administrative task that I have. But day to day, it's keeping track of donations that come in, making sure that I have records of who donated what material and stuff, so that we can make sure that we know where our material is coming from and stuff like. So I track that. I also track the number of research requests that I am receiving, so that I can, you know, in those reports that I have to do, I can say, you know, in 2020, I fulfilled 100 research requests. In 2019, I fulfilled 175 research requests. You can see the difference in number there and stuff like that. You know, that was 2019 and then 2020 happened. Yeah. And stuff like that. So again, you know, I do track all of that type of information. And so really that's a lot of what I do administratively is kind of groundwork for those major reports that I have to do when it comes to tracking where my donations are coming from, where they, you know, the number of research requests that I'm helping to fulfill, and stuff like that. So that all ties into part of the administrative role that I have here.
So although the stereotype of an archivist might project an image of a stooped over academic never leaving the dimly lit room full of dusty manuscripts, your job takes you outside of a well-lit and clean archives quite frequently. Can you tell us about your role in conducting outreach and education?
So that's actually probably one of my favorite parts of the job. I love a good research hunt and stuff like that, but I also really enjoy talking with people about history and about what I'm able to do here in the Synod Archives. So in a typical year, I would have an informational table at places like our Synod Convention, district conventions, LWMS, the Lutheran Women's Missionary Society, does an annual convention. I normally have a table there. And that just really gives me an opportunity to reach out to people who aren't local, who are, you know, they're from around the country. They are Wells members. And they may not even know that we have an archive. So I'm able to let them know I'm here as a resource. You know, we have pastors that are further out in our synod, you know, out west in, you know, in Colorado or California, who don't know that I'm available to help them, that I have resources here that can help them and their congregation, or even that I'm looking for them to donate things to the archive. You know, I'm wanting them to send me bulletins from anniversaries. And when they write those church histories, I would love to have a copy here in the archive. So that really gives me an opportunity to talk to people about what I'm able to help them with, but then also how they can help me here in the Synod Archive by sending me those types of materials and stuff like that. I speak to small groups at congregations. I've spoken to women's groups at congregations. I've spoken to senior groups at congregations. I've met with congregations that have a historical committee, and I've spoken to their historical committee about how they can preserve their own documents within their congregations. I've met with school groups, you know, history classes at Luther Prep or German class, you know, advanced German students at Luther Prep and stuff like that, because up until the 1930s, a lot of our synod materials were in German. So it's a great resource then for German students to work on their translating skills and stuff like that. So there's really a lot of different things where I'm able to apply, you know, the type of work that I do in the archive or research skills to various groups, you know, that aren't just history classes. And stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun to get out and meet people from around the country who have a love for our synod, who share our same faith and stuff like that, and teach them a little bit more about our synod's history and the things that I can help them with.
Yeah. So does that kind of mean as the Wells archivist, you're kind of the face of Wells history to the Synod? Is that you know, have you ever thought of it that way? But you are kind of, I am Wells history coming to you in a way.
A little bit. Yeah. I mean, when it comes to more of like the academic side of Wells history and stuff like that, people might be a little bit more familiar with an organization called the Wells Historical Institute. For a long time, they have been the face of Wells history and stuff like that, and everything. And I work very closely with them, with the Wells Institute or Historical Institute, to really try and promote interest in Wells history, and stuff like that. So we each, you know, they have a little bit different role than what I do, when it comes to, you know, the preservation and the organizing and the cataloging and stuff like that. But we work very closely together. And in fact, if you happen to stop by my table, you know, at one of these conferences or these conventions, you'll see that my table is a joint table with the Historical Institute. And stuff, because really at events like that, our main goal is to let people know that we have resources available to them if they are interested in history or if they want to learn about a certain aspect of history. You know, between the primary source material that I have here in the archive and then, you know, the publications and the articles and stuff the Historical Institute publishes, you know, we can cover a variety of different topics in Wells history and have something for all different types of interest in Walls history.
Yeah, thanks for that explanation then. Yeah, I was going to ask later about the Wells Historical Institute and your relationship with them, but you're both promoting Wells history, but kind of in your own way, kind of they have the polished project and you're on the other end helping people with that research. Is that a fair way to summarize it? Okay.
Yes. I'm helping those authors get to that polished product of Synod history with their journal articles and stuff like that. So, but right, we do work together then because, like I said, our goal is the same. It's promotion and education of Walls history.
Yeah. So as you go through, you mentioned a whole lot of different kinds of people, classrooms, historical committees, congregations. Do you have resources for people to kind of get them started on a research project? Like, for example, here are things a congregation should look for if they're going to write a congregational history, or maybe here's a sample outline if you're going to write a history book. Do you have stuff like that?
So something along those lines, I really don't, because the topics are so varied, and writing history is a very personal endeavor. You talk to the people who write books on, historical books and stuff like that. And usually what draws them to a topic is a deep personal interest in that topic. And usually when they're writing that history, the way they go about doing the research and writing it, it's all related to that personal interest. So everybody does that process a little bit differently. What I provide for congregations is I provide kind of the outline of things that each congregation should be keeping as part of their history. So things like, bulletins from anniversary services and installations of their pastors and called workers, dedications of new buildings, those types that, those bulletins from those kind of bigger events and special services, keep copies of those and stuff like that. I tell them keep copies of all of the meeting minutes from the various committees and organizations that you have at your church council, voters meeting minutes, elders meeting minutes, those types of things. So I provide the resources then to kind of help guide congregations in what to keep and stuff. And then all of those things then can be utilized when it comes time to write a church history or put together a timeline for an anniversary and stuff like that, because then they have a lot of those primary sources from their congregation's history right there in front of them, rather than having to contact there that I suggest for congregations, not so much in how to write those histories. I do have examples from congregations that, I'm happy to share with them. Or, if I know of another Wells church in their area that has just gone through this process, I might work to connect them together so that, the church that's currently doing it can ask questions of the church that just completed that process. And stuff. So that's really where I try and help guide them.
That makes a lot of sense. So I also wanted to ask a bit more about your professional development. What role does that have in your work as the Wells Archivist?
Keeping up with all of the technology changes that happen. One of my favorite kind of shock and awe things to do when I have school groups come through here, and they ask me, why do I keep the paper from all of these things? Why don't I just scan it and then get rid of it? And one of my favorite things to do is pull out a floppy disk and show them a floppy disk and say, well, so this floppy disk is from, like 1998 or something like that and everything. I don't have a way to access this on my computer. I don't know what's on this floppy disk because I don't have that drive anymore on my computer. But I can go back to my archives and I can pull out a piece of paper from 1827. And if I could read German, I could tell you exactly what it says on there because I have that physical paper in front of me. So one of the big challenges as an archivist is really just staying on top of all of the technology changes that are just flooding our world today. And it's things like how we save things. You know, floppy disks were huge. Now they are completely irrelevant. You know, what format should I save a scan in to where it's still going to be able to be accessed a few years from now? So when it comes to professional development, there are devoted organizations for archivists to be a part of where we can have these conversations with each other and we can bounce ideas off of each other or we can ask questions of each other. You know, how do you handle this in your archives? What do you do about this? Here's what I do for this topic. And stuff. So as part of my professional development, I'm a member of a couple of those different organizations. You know, we have virtual conferences, we have in-person conferences where we can learn, you know, what's the latest when it comes to scanning documents. Do we save them as a PDF? Is there a new format that's coming out? How does that compare? And stuff, because really that is the biggest challenge that we face, especially in today's society where people aren't creating paper anymore. They're creating digital files or they're creating, everything is digital and stuff. And we are creating more material every day than people could create in a year or in 2 years. And how do we sift through and pick what's worth saving? And because saving digital material, it takes up a lot of space, making it very expensive. So you have to really have those priorities of, okay, what do we save? How do we save it? How do we make sure it's not getting corrupt or lost down, you know, a black hole of technology? And so that's where professional development is key to stay involved with throughout your career as an archivist.
Yeah, like any profession, you got to keep up with developments and know how to how other people are doing your job in a different way and maybe better.
Right.
Yeah. So I think you mentioned earlier that you're part of other groups and networks. You get to talk with other archivists and kind of get feedback from each other. Have you been able to meet with the handful of the other Lutheran archivists in the nation?
Yes, actually, there's an organization called the Lutheran Historical Conference. And I was introduced to that conference by one of my former professors from Wisconsin Lutheran College who has a passion for Lutheran history. He's involved with that organization. And he introduced me to it. And it's a great way to connect with other Lutheran historians and Lutheran archivists who understand some of the challenges of working in a church archive. You know, we do deal with material that is a little bit different than what a more traditional archive deals with. Like I said, you know, you don't find all the personal papers here and stuff like that. A lot of our research requests are slightly different than what you would get in a more traditional archive. And we deal with material that we might not actually be able to read. I don't know German. All of our synod history up to a certain point is written in German. That provides a little bit of a roadblock for me when it comes to certain things. And I'm very blessed that I have volunteers that can read and interpret the German for me and help me with that. But you know, there are a lot of other Lutheran archivists that have that same challenge. You know, they're working with material that they, you know, sometimes it's school papers from pastors that are written in Greek and Hebrew. that's a very specific language that not a lot, you know, very few archivists are trained in that unless they have, a background as a pastor or something like that. So we have some of those unique challenges and stuff like that. We serve a very specific community usually. You know, we're helping serve congregations and pastors, not just average people who are interested in history and stuff like that. It's kind of a fine niche that we have here. And so having that support from the other archivists is really, it's fantastic to be able to have those conversations with them and find out how they do things or what kind of challenges they've been able to overcome. So that organization in particular is really fantastic. There's several Wells historians that are part of this organization. There's several Missouri Synod historians and archivists that are part of that, and then a lot of ELCA historians and archivists that are a part of that. And really, it's nice too because then we're able to forge those relationships to where if I'm not able to answer a research request because I feel that the congregation they were asking about was a Missouri Synod church and not a Wells church. We have those personal relationships then that we're able to connect the researcher to the organization that's going to be able to help them with their research and stuff like that. And that's really kind of key because Lutheran history, especially dating back into, the late 1800s, early 1900s, a lot of it is intertwined. And I might not have specifically what they're looking for, but I know that the Missouri Synod might be able to help them or the ELCA might be able to help them. And then, instead of just saying, oh, you need to contact, the Concordia Historical Institute, I can give them those names and that contact information and tell them, let them know that I sent you over there. If they have other questions, they can reach out to me and really make that kind of personal connection for the researcher too, because that's very helpful for them. It can be very intimidating to start historical research. So we want to make sure that we're making that process as smooth as possible for the researcher.
Yeah, that's very helpful because it's rather common to find pastors, individuals, congregations that were connected with more than one Lutheran organization that are still divided today. The ELCA is made up of dozens of former synods, and they kind of have a bigger mess just because they have so many different lineages to follow. Whereas, with Wells or Missouri LCMS, it's kind of more of a straight line to trace. But still, even our own synod, as you very well know, is that merger of other synods in the past too. And you kind of have to have your Michigan Synod file and your Minnesota Synod file, and then it merges together. But Lutheran history is fun partially because it is so complex. Just keeping it all straight. And those other resources can help you. Now to some more, it's all been very practical today, but I got some practical questions I've heard from other people, and I thought I'd share them with you. Some of my classmates who are pastors have asked, what are they supposed to do with historic documents or items in their congregations? And maybe what advice do you have for pastors or really anyone who handles historic items in a congregation?
So the first thing I always tell people is just check to see what these historic items are and stuff like that. And like I said, I provide congregations and pastors and individuals with kind of the guidelines of what historical documents you should be saving. I think a lot of times people think of historical documents as, from the early 1900s or, more than a certain number of years ago suddenly makes a document historical. You can write a church history today and tomorrow it's a historical document because it's something that's important for your organization. And really that's key. Just making sure that you know what is important to your congregation and stuff. That's what makes it more of a historical document than the date of when it was written and stuff. So I have those guidelines for people. Any, you know, they're on the website for the Synod Archives. If you go to wells.net and under about, you can click to the archives page, and it'll give you kind of those guidelines of things that you should be saving. But I also really encourage individuals, pastors, congregations, reach out to me. That's part of what I'm here for, is to help in congregations and stuff like that. You can call me, you can email me, and I'll sit down and you can send me a list of what you have, and I'll tell you, yes, keep that. No, don't worry about that. And in fact, I did that yesterday with a pastor who he'd been with his congregation for about a year now. So he's got his feet under him as to, you know, learning about the congregation, learning the history of the congregation and stuff like that. So now he just wanted to go over with me the types of things that he had found and what should he do with these documents, and what about, you know, is it necessary to save all of this? And we were able to go through each of those things individually and stuff like that. So that's part of what I am here for as a support role for our synod, is to go through and answer those types of questions. In a normal year, I will go and I will visit congregations. Granted, you know, that it needs to be fairly local, but I will go and I will meet with, you know, church secretaries or pastors, and they, you know, they have everything. They're just like, I don't know what to do with this stuff, and I'll help you figure that out and stuff. We can set up Zoom meetings now. That's a thing, and we can do this. To where, you know, you don't have to always make those decisions by yourself. That's part of what I'm here to help you with. So really, all you have to do is just reach out. And it can be as simple as saying, do you have time to chat with me about some of the things that I have found in this congregation? And yes, let's schedule a time to talk and work through those things that you have. Unfortunately, since I am, you know, the only archivist, it's hard for me to reach out to individual congregations and stuff. So I do rely very heavily on congregations reaching out to me, which it can seem intimidating. But like I said, I love helping congregations figure this out. And it can be as simple as a phone call of, can I ask you a few questions? Yes, of course. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, you're not a very scary person to talk to. So yeah, shouldn't be intimidating. Well, thank but you. Yeah, yeah, no, it's just that idea. Oh, I'm going to an official, professional historian here, and it's yeah, I can see why that could be intimidating.
And sometimes it's just the amount of material that is amassed in a church basement in the corner. You know, a pastor comes in, and you know, he, you know, a pastor leaves a congregation and he's been there for 30 years and he retires, and a new pastor comes in, and you're faced with, you know, file cabinets upon file cabinets that are just overflowing with material, or boxes in the basement, and you don't even know where to start and stuff. And I can help with that too. I can help provide a little bit of guidance on, you know, as you open that first filing cabinet drawer, here's the types of things to be looking for and stuff. Because even just knowing where to start can feel overwhelming at times.
Yeah, especially like most pastors, if they're pretty busy with a lot of other things,
right?
You know, that pile of papers doesn't need ministering to. They're important, right, but there are a lot of other priorities. On one hand, there are two maybe bad things to do, is just ignore it forever. And the other worst thing to do would just be to throw it all away. You'll help them figure out a good balance, and maybe turn to volunteers who know what they're doing too, would be a good advice.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and I think that's one thing that really shouldn't intimidate people when it comes to, you know, historical documents and stuff like that. Anybody can work to put things, you know, in an order. Anybody can group all of the bulletins together, and anybody can group, you know, all of the voters' meeting minutes together and stuff like that. It really isn't something that you need a lot of training with and stuff like that, sometimes all you need is just the guidance of what do I need to keep. And then each congregation can work out their own organizational system with it. What works for that congregation might not work for another congregation. And you can rely on people who want to serve the congregation, but maybe, don't feel that they have, an outreach frame of mind or something like that. Just helping the pastor and helping the secretary keep those things organized is a huge mental load that you can relieve for them and stuff like that. So really anyone can go in and help with this. It's just a matter of knowing what to keep and what not to keep.
So you are focused on Wells history, and that leads into facilitating help with research and pastors and congregations. But you mentioned sometimes there are people looking for kind of family history, and they're not really going to get that at Wells Archives because that's not its purpose. But do you have any advice or ideas for families who want to preserve some aspect of their family's Lutheran history?
So I always tell people, it's less common these days, but a lot of times people contact me, and they'll say, we were going through grandma's house and we found the family Bible. What do we do with the family Bible? And stuff. And I always tell people, as much as you can, keep that with your family, and stuff like that. That right there is a great resource, when it comes to preserving your family's history and stuff like that. And everything. And, just in more practical terms and stuff like that, if you have a place in your house that, has air conditioning in the summertime and is heated to a certain extent in the wintertime, try and keep those materials there. Don't just put them in the corner of the damp, cold basement, and stuff like that. So a little bit more practical when it comes to preserving things. You can go as far as ordering, specific archival storage boxes and folders and stuff like that, but you don't have to. You can organize things nicely, make sure that papers aren't folded, that you can have them flat, and stuff like that. Just little things like that. And really the biggest thing is keeping them in a spot in your home where there is some climate control. Like I said, a little bit of air conditioning in the summertime if you live in a place where it gets hot and humid, a little bit of heat in the wintertime to keep things from going, getting too cold. Because really when it comes down to personal archives, what you're looking for is just more of a consistent temperature and humidity control. You don't have to worry about keeping it between, 30 and 45% humidity and, between 55 and 62 degrees. You don't have to worry about that. But if you can keep things a little bit more consistent, instead of going from, 55 in the wintertime to a room that, in the attic that's, exposed to those elements and gets up to 95 with 90% humidity and stuff like that, you can go a long way in preserving your own family history and your family documents and stuff like that by just keeping things consistent with the temperature and humidity levels. And stuff. And then it really comes down to each individual family. What's important to your family? Are photographs important to your family? Then you want to try and make sure that you have those photographs, you have them labeled, who's in them. Sit down with, your mom or your dad or your grandparents and see if they can tell you who's in some of the photographs where you don't recognize people. Ask them to tell you, the story behind these photographs from the Grand Canyon. When did you go? Who did you go with? How long were you there? And so, and naturally those conversations will start flowing and you can just learn a lot just by asking them, to help you identify people in pictures. If letter writing was a big part of your family and stuff like that, preserve those letters, put them in chronological order. Who are they from? That sort of a thing. If the writer or the recipient of the letter is still with you, ask them about it and stuff like that. It really is just a matter of figuring out what are those important documents and items in your family's history, and then learning what you can about them while you have that opportunity.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that advice. I hope our listeners put that advice into action, because at the end of the day, you're probably most, if you're interested in it, you're the best person to preserve that history and to tell its story.
Right.
Yeah. So a question I just kind of thought up for fun here as we wrap up our interview today. In the Wells Archives, is there a Holy Grail item or document for which you want listeners to keep an open eye? Is there just like a record or a sermon or something that everyone's asking for and you can't find?
So it's really, you know, there are certain things that I do tell people, you know, keep an eye out for and stuff like that, because for so long, the archives was run by volunteers and stuff like that. And it was people who had a genuine interest and a genuine love for our Synod history. But there are gaps within our collection. There are certain presidents that we don't have papers from and stuff like that. So there's a couple of different presidents who served our Synod in the early 1900s that we really don't have much material from. It's things like that. Pictures are always, pictures of congregations of the actual physical church building. So we get a lot of requests for pictures of the congregations, and I don't have many individual congregation pictures. Same goes for pastors. When congregations write their histories and stuff like that, it's always nice to have a picture of that very first pastor that served your congregation and stuff like that. It's also very challenging to find a picture of a pastor from 1875 that, you know, the pictures weren't a big thing back then. So when we find them, they're kind of like those little gold nuggets and stuff like that, that you're able to share with a congregation. Like, here's a picture of your first pastor. As you're going through and you're cleaning out, you know, a basement of a grandparent who was in the ministry and stuff like that, and you stumble across, you know, old pictures and stuff like that, go ahead, take a look through them. You might find a picture of that congregation that they first served or things like that. So pictures are really a good thing and stuff like that. And like I said, there are some gaps that we have when it comes to like collections from Synod leadership roles and everything, because for a long time, what people don't really know about our Synod's history is that our Synod leadership, our presidents, they were also parish pastors. And it really wasn't until after, I believe it was in the late 1950s into the 1960s that the president of our Synod was a full-time position. And the headquarters for our Synod moved around based on where the president was a pastor. So for a part of our Synod's history, the pastor who served as our Synod's president was based in Minnesota. So technically our Synod was based in Minnesota during his time as president. And because of that, we do have, you know, those gaps in papers for the Synod history, just because, you know, that pastor was based in Minnesota, and for whatever reason, his papers never made it down to the main collection of archives. There are a few things that I request that people, kind of keep an eye out for and stuff like that. But there's also a lot that we have here that's exciting to share with people. And one of my favorite things to pull out is we have the original Synod Constitution that has the signature of our founding pastors on it and everything. So that's kind of a fun, neat thing that I like to pull out when we have, especially students come through who, you know, have just gone through a segment on Synod history or something like that. And it's neat to be able to show them things that they're learning in class, we actually have those documents and stuff to back up what they're learning.
That is really neat. The more hands-on, the more visual history gets, I think it's just easier to make a connection, and that makes it more meaningful somehow. So
exactly.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, I hope many people, when possible, can come in and visit the mission center there, the ministry center, and stop by and see the history department, I guess, of the building. I have not been there myself, actually, so I need to get over there when I can. But finally, if someone wanted to contact you either about research or about anything else, how can they reach you? How can they get in touch with you?
Sure. So the best way to do that is through the Wells website, wells.net. And when you go to wells.net, you can, there's tabs at the top of the page. You can hover over the About section and it'll drop down and there'll be a link for our archives and stuff. And once you go to the archives page, there's a down towards the bottom, there's a big red button that you can click and it says contact the archivist. And it'll take you to an online form that you can fill out and that goes directly to me. And you can ask your research requests through that. You can ask to, you know, about donations. If you have questions about materials to be donated to the archives, you can ask that. If you're just looking for general information about how to do archive research and stuff like that, all of those questions you can ask and reach out to me through that big contact the Synod Archivist button. And like I said, I do my best to make sure that I am staying on top of those requests and those questions so that there's not, you know, usually there's not a big turnaround time and stuff like that. I'm able to handle those questions and those requests usually within 24 to 48 hours of when they are submitted. And stuff. And like I said, I try and stay in contact with people too. If it's going to take me a little bit longer, I'll let you know that so that you're not just sitting around wondering if your question went into, you know, a black hole of the internet or something like that. And stuff. I want to make sure that you know I've got it. I'm working on it, and we'll go from there.
Well, thank you for sharing. I hope after today's podcast, you'll have more work to do. Maybe I don't know if you want that, but I hope people do take advantage of your services and the work that you do for the Synod. So Susan Willems, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.